Out of the dark of the deep range and into the light of the deep strange, cometh the hour, cometh the mothership that is Coast to Coast AM. And how are you this evening? It's good to be with you. John B. Wells in the left seat for the evening. And tonight on the program, Gerald Clark. He was on the program with Mr. Norrie back a couple of months ago. However, there's so much to talk about. 8 hours wouldn't get it. But he'll be with us for the program tonight. And we will discuss many things, mostly the Anunnaki of Nibiru. I'm probably saying it wrong, but I can't help it. Hope you had a good week. And we are now in certain parts of the country and world into the first day of the week. Somebody sent an email last weekend and said, why do you insist on calling Sunday the first day of the week? Because it is. Monday is the first day of the work week for the proletariat, you see. And so, my comrades, my people, let's just touch on a couple of things. This video, when it went to YouTube, wound up being one of the most disliked ever. If it's not the most disliked, thumbs down thing in the history of YouTube, it'll certainly do until the most disliked video is posted on YouTube, and that is the NSA's Director General Keith Alexander actually demanded Thursday, I'm taking this from Glenn Greenwald, the London Guardian, he demanded Thursday that the reporting being done by newspapers around the world on this secret surveillance system be halted. Yes, the head of the embattled National Security Agency, General Keith Alexander, is accusing journalists of selling his agency's document and is calling for an end to the steady stream of public disclosures of secrets snatched by former contractor Edward Snowden. Quote, I think it's wrong that the newspaper reporters have all these documents, the 50,000 whatever they have, and are selling them and giving them out as if these, you know, it just doesn't make sense. Neither did your sentence, sir. He said it in an interview with the Defense Department's Armed with Science blog. Continuing the quote, we ought to come up with a way of stopping it. I don't know how to do that. That's more the courts and the policymakers. But from my perspective, it's wrong to allow this to go on. Well, there's this old movie called Deadline with Humphrey Bogart. And, the editor uses the final issues of his paper to crusade against this gangster. And so guy's going, what is that? Bogart's got him on the phone. What is that? What's going on? What's up? And Bogart replies, that's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing. And so, there it is, sir. It's the press. And at least so far, there's nothing you can do about it. Anyway, tonight when we get Gerald Clark on the line, we're going to talk about some very, very strange stuff. You know, privacy, as we have known it, is pretty much floated on downstream. Unless, of course, we can get it back through the courts. DARPA is developing an implant that can read brain signals in real time. I'm telling you, this is going to be a fantastic interview. Gerald Clark is a 1994 graduate of University of California at San Diego. He holds an MSCE in electronic circuits and systems and a Bachelor's of Science in Computer Engineering. He's the author of several papers in the communications and electronics field, well known for his work in the San Diego high technology industry, awarded several patents in the free space optical laser communications field, and during the years 96 through 02, working as a telecommunications executive, his business travels took him to various parts of the world, exposing him to a plethora of cultures, which acted as a catalyst for his research into mankind's earliest technologies and accomplishments, including the cultures of, yes, Mesopotamia and the surrounding areas of Turkey, Egypt, Persia, and Iraq, eventually leading to the, see if I can pronounce this correctly, cuneiform inscribed tablets left by the Sumerians. And who are these Anunnakis anyway? And what's up? And what is his connection with Zachariah Sitchin's. Almost said Stitchin's. Actually, I did say it. Forget it. Anyway, this is going to be a good one. UFO sightings, the Bible, all kinds of things. So get ready. You're going to need a proper mug of tea for this one tonight, because this should really be quite an eye-opener. Here's the thing. You know, I keep making this reference to the awakening of 2012. We were getting ready for the awakening. Well, behold, the awakening has been well underway all the way through 2013 and shows no signs of slowing down. And even the NSA directors are saying, well, you've just got to stop this. It's like it's taken on a life of its own now. It's not going to stop. Behold, here comes some more on the Saturday night edition of Coast to Coast AM. Hang on tight and stand by. His book, The Anunnaki of Nibiru, Mankind's Forgotten Creators, Enslavers, Saviors, and Hidden Architects of the New World Order. Without further ado, let us welcome onto the bridge in the mothership, Gerald Clark. Welcome, sir.
Hey, John. It's really nice to be here tonight, and welcome to all your listeners.
You know, you've been around quite a bit. What a remarkable career. So, you know, for those who missed the program the last time that you were on and are unfamiliar with your work, because there is you have no website. This is unusual. Are you trying to withdraw from the system, or what's up?
I have Luddite tendencies, but I actually have commissioned to get my website done. It'll be GeraldClark77.com as soon as it's up.
Okay. Okay. All right. Very Gerald Clark 77. Yeah.
Yes.
And it's coming. Okay.
Yep.
Well, tell us all about you and how you started and decided, well, I think I'll go to the University of California at San Diego and get into electronics. I mean, were you just inclined that way? Did you build Heath Kit radios when you were a kid, or just how did you become the man that you are and then go on to do the, rather adventurous work that you have taken on?
Well, I'm not sure how far I'm allowed to go back. I guess we have
go back
time,
as far as you like. We got the whole show.
Well, I was born in California, and by the time I was three, my folks moved us back to the Midwest, and specifically, we ended up in the northwest corner of Arkansas. And my stepfather had roots in Oklahoma, so it kind of made sense for him. But my mother and father were both working in the aircraft assembly business up in the Long Beach area when they met.
Gotcha.
So I was born in California and got transplanted when I was seven. To the northwest corner of Arkansas, where we lived on a very remote farm.
Yeah, there's some culture shock for you.
Well, it was interesting. I was actually kind of embarrassed. I had this California stigma about me. I'm like, you know, I'm better than you kind of thing. So I didn't associate with people like I probably should have. And I'll get back to that. But anyway, in the ninth grade, I got involved in science. And I think I had a natural science bent anyway. I was constantly taking things apart, trying to figure things out. And so I built a small solar tracker, having seen a similar design in Popular Mechanics. And the attractive part about it was it used a simple little servo, a dual-acting servo that had an expandable gas either side of it that was propane. Like I welded some propane tanks. And then it had a little arm that would turn it toward the sun with some blinders. Pretty simple. And it worked, and I won second place for it in the state science fair contest.
Cool.
And my science fair teacher was quite thrilled. Anyway, I got exposed to the Secretary of Energy at that time and started thinking about researching this area. So it stuck with me, and it was an idea I wanted to expand my research sometime in the future, even though it wasn't really clear to me how I was going to do that. But I had the certificate in my hand, and it was my ticket out of kind of a very poor situation we were living in.
And
So academia seemed to me like the way out of a potential life of poverty. And a lot of farmers in that area were very poor.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So from there, my real father still lived in San Diego, so I had aspirations to go to college. I was the first one in my family to do it. So I went back to California when I was 17, so I was on a farm, living like a farm boy from 7 to 17, and I absolutely loved it. It made me the person I am today.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so I went back to UCSD in San Diego, where I thought I was going to establish residency and finish up my last year of high school and go to college. That was my plan. And so while I was there, I got exposed to a guy who was heavy into flying, and it was my childhood dream to fly. And he owned a P-51 Mustang that he was restoring out of Montgomery Field here in San Diego. And here I was, a 17-year-old with dreams of flying, and this guy was letting me close to it on frequent occasions. And so it kind of fanned the flames for me to want to live my dream. Well, while I was in college at UCSD in electrical engineering. I'd just gotten in there, and everything was set. I got a call from somebody in the aviation business who wanted to know if I wanted to take a flight slot, because I'd taken a test under the guidance of this guy who had the P-51 Mustang. His name was Bill Spears, by the way. He's kind of a well-known guy.
Yeah.
He ended up dying in that P-51 when one of the oil valves went out and smeared oil on his windshield. He crashed the thing. So anyway, so I went off and decided I was going to do my childhood dream, and I spent 7 years in the Army flying helicopters.
Wow.
So that was an absolute dream come true for me. I wasn't so much about the institution as I was about flying, but I still served my country honorably for 7 years, and I really have a deep honor and bond with all those who are still serving.
Understood. Hey, listen, before we stray too far from the Mustang, was it the D model or the H model?
It was the D model.
Oh, there's not much rudder on that thing.
Yeah. I never got to fly it. He was still restoring it. The part I got exposed to, he was taking parts and having them heat tempered and shuttling them back and forth up to some factory in L.A. where they were doing this work for him. And so it was a neat experience, though, to be exposed to something like that.
Yeah, I'll bet. I've always wanted one of those, but they're about $1 million now, so forget about it.
No. Yeah, so I had aspirations of being an electrical engineer in UCSD, and I put that on hold for 7 years, and got about 1,500 flight hours getting flown all over the place. I did 5 rotations at the National Training Center at Fort Irwin, California, where I got exposed to some really neat high-tech equipment that was being used for battle simulations, including the MILES integrated laser system. So that was kind of neat. And had a neat encounter there while we were at what they called the Star Wars building on top of the Bicycle Lake Army Airfield, where they used to do the debriefings. We were there one day after a battle sequence, a simulated sequence against the motorized rifle regiment of the Soviets. That's how they were training way back then. And this was about circa 1985, by the way. So Tom Clancy showed up there, and he was doing research for one of his books, and it really inspired me. So I read all Tom Clancy's books while I was in the military there.
Excellent.
Yeah. So once I got out of the military, I came back to San Diego, having served in Korea and spent a lot of time in Germany, and 4 years in Fort Raleigh, Kansas, in the first attack helicopter battalion. And the quarter cav, I was an air cavalry member at the last year of my service there. So anyway, I left there in 1989, came back to San Diego, determined to finish up my engineering degree. And that's exactly what I did. So I went right back to UCSD, right back to Rail Valley College, and finished up my engineering degree.
What kind of helicopters were you flying? Comanches or?
Well, I started. Well, we had at Fort Riley, we had the AH-1S Cobras, and then we had the modernized Cobras across the airfield, which the cavalry had. And the first attack helicopter battalion, when I left there in 1990, was just getting brand new Apaches from Mesa, Arizona. These were my last orders, to go pick up an Apache in Mesa, Arizona, go for unit training at Fort Hood, Texas, and then Fort Rucker flight school or flight training school, where I was going to be an instructor pilot, and then off to Germany for 3 years. And I gave that up to go back and study engineering. But I really loved flying, and I really loved the brotherhood of the aviators.
Oh, yeah, it gets in your blood, and it stays there, doesn't it?
It's never left. As a matter of fact, I'm kind of a hard critter to deal with. We swore oaths when we were in flight school not to lie, cheat, or steal, or tolerate anybody that does. And we try living like that in this order of reality and see what happens. There's a lot of bird that flies, yeah. Mm-hmm. So from there, I got back to San Diego, and I got involved in a very interesting startup company. This might tie us into this DARPA question that you had about the 3D printing. Yeah. And then I got involved in what's called the Rotorcraft Pilot Associate Program, where they wanted to capture everything I knew about taking an aircraft in complex simulation environments and essentially picking my brain, capturing it in rules, and then encoding this in an unmanned autonomous vehicle like a drone in order to have it do what you do. Right. So this was integrated. And back in 1989, I did this, and we encoded into an artificial intelligent language called CLIPS, which was C Language Integrated Production Systems. And it's used by a lot of the neurology and, I don't know, the different computer science and neurology specialists that they have in the education programs now. So they're into this data mining idea heavily.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so
on every level, it seems.
Yes, at every level. So from there, I ended up getting in, and I learned a whole lot about evolutionary algorithms and all the crazy things that model the brain, model how what's interesting in environment, sensor fusion, and all those kind of things. And we did a lot of work. I did this for 7 years. So it was a company called Reticular Systems, and it was based on, believe it or not, the brain mechanism, the reticular activating system that caused awareness and attention. And we were very focused on that in this sensor fusion arena. Have you heard of that?
Not really. I'm not going to tell you that I have. Maybe just a little blip in a Jane's Defense publication of some sort, but not really.
Right. Well, this was a DARPA program, and anytime DARPA is involved, I'm sure they're listening. Anytime DARPA is involved, it's for defense purposes, and they can tell you it's about, maybe for your health, or they're trying to help Parkinson's, or whatever it is they put out the cover story. But ultimately, if it's developed for DARPA, it's developed for the Department of Defense.
Sure.
So, the kind of technology they end up with is not something I ended up being real supportive of. So later on, I ended up working at Turing Communications, where I was doing, actually before that, I was at the Loral Telemetry and Instrumentation, where I was doing satellite programs. And that was really interesting, learning about how data is put on and off carriers and so on and so forth. It made me really start thinking about how data could be put on and off a carrier relative to humans later in my life. So I've watched that space very closely as well.
I've heard a report recently about someone near and dear to me just said, listen, I heard it. I could tell by the sound where it was coming from. And when the light shifted just slightly, it gave itself away. This thing was cloaked. I mean, anything that we hear about is normally 30 years behind what's actually out there. Are they getting close to being able to cloak these craft, or is there anything to suggest they've already done it?
Well, I was looking at an article on 3D printing where this guy from, where is he from? He's at Duke University, and his name
Yaroslav.
Can you pronounce his last name? Yeah, well, he's working on an invisibility cloak, and I've been seeing this going on for a while. So what do we know about visible and invisible and microwave energy in terms of its cloaking its effect on a reflective object? And that's really what it comes down to, is what do we know? Can we do it? Well, we see in the B-2 stealth bombers that if you adjust the angles of the reflective material such that the energy doesn't go back to the emanating source, that you don't get a reflection. Or if you do get one, it's so small it looks like a bird. And that's what, that's essentially what's going on with the B-2 stealth program. Those kinds. So it's a passive type of cloaking, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I've heard about this stuff called, somebody was calling it smart skin. Oh, there you go. There you go. Beautiful. Well, is there anything to suggest that we're still online? Sky Chief Brian, are we online? How about that? I'm telling you. I'll tell you a quick story. Right down here at the undisclosable location, someone near and dear to me, who's absolutely, his credentials are beyond reproach, showed me a little movie that he had taken on his little iPhone 4. And what it looked like to me was people will say, it was just spotlights. No, we know what they look like. This will be posted eventually on Caravan to Midnight. A half dozen little light orbs all gathered together in a little line. You know, sometimes they'll just kind of, here we are. And then they proceeded to follow each other into a very dim light that looked like moonlight behind a cloud. But it wasn't. It was a full moon that night, but this was not the moon. And one after another, these six just added to this dim little moon behind the cloud's light, and it became brighter and brighter and brighter. And then three or four or five, six other ones joined it. And it looked like the boys, and maybe the girls too, just all joining back up to the mothership. Strange. Well, apparently, maybe DARPA pulled the plug. Maybe they'll plug it back in. We'll do our best to get back online with Gerald Clark in just a moment. This is Coast to Coast AM. Yes, a right brutal bunch of buggers they have been. And will be again, I predict. Ask anyone who's been probed. Right. I don't really understand why it is. Yes, actually I do. But you know what? Just to put a weed up that kilt, I'm going to read you some more. DutchNews.nl, America's NSA tapped 1.8 million Dutch phone numbers in 1 month. The American National Security Agency tapped 1.1 million Dutch telephones in 1 month alone as part of its boundless informant surveillance program with two M's and an E, Dutch media reported on Monday. The raw information was first published by Der Spiegel, in June, but has now been interpreted by Dutch technology website Tweakers, following publication in Le Monde. That's the world. Between the beginning of December and beginning of January, 1.8 million Dutch phone numbers were tapped into by the NSA, recording information about number and possibly location, Tweakers said. This comes from one of my very favorite websites, Full Spectrum Dominance, with dashes between the words, .com. The numbers were compared against a database of suspect numbers, and Tweaker says if a number was on the list, calls to and from the number were listened to. In Germany, 500 million numbers were picked up. In France, 70 million. Paris has now summoned the U.S. ambassador to explain events. According to Le Monde, documents show the NSA was allegedly targeting not only terrorist suspect, but politicians, business people, and others. The raw information comes from whistleblower Fast Eddie Snowden. Yeah. There's a quote here by Klaus Dijkhoff, a VVD parliamentarian. Quote, if it was the Chinese or the Russians, then no one would be surprised. But this is an ally, and that makes it extra disappointing. Indeed. Well, we've got the screens up now. We've called on occupants of interplanetary craft to perhaps put a field around the mothership so we might maintain our communications link with our guest tonight, Gerald Clark. Isn't it funny? Just as you get to a salient point, I thought the man had been vaporized. We shall see when we return on Coast to Coast AM. Gerald, are you there?
I'm here.
Are you okay?
I never heard such a sound in my phone before, I have to say.
Yeah, you should have heard it through headphones. Oof.
Really?
Yeah, I thought you'd been vaporized, and maybe me too.
I may have lost a few brain cells, but I'm ready to go.
Where the heck were we?
I think I was about to switch over from passive invisibility cloaks to something a little more active that this researcher is working on.
Is that that smart skin thing?
Mm-hmm.
Ah.
So it's quite interesting what they're doing, and they've only picked the 9.7 to 10.1 gigahertz where they're running this thing through a microscopic modulator, which is a small conductive cylinder that takes in these wavelengths and then sends them out the cloak side of the object that they're trying to get the radar signature on, and it disperses the energy orthogonal and up into the atmosphere on the cloak side so it doesn't shoot back to the transmitting side. So they're doing this in the gigahertz range, and I guess the concern is, well, what about if you do it in visible light range, 400 to 700 nanometers? And these guys say, at the bottom of the article, they can do it.
No kidding.
Yep.
If we're just hearing about it now, It seems like they've probably been able to do it for a while, but that's probably me just being cynical again.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. Well, they've been using different decoys and things on the battlefield for eons, you know, whether it was a simulated tank that you blew up or whether it was a camouflage technique. But decoys are very, very big in military tactics. So I think this would be a significant military advantage to anybody who had this technology.
Well, I'll say, you know, it begs the question. There have been lots of allegations, declarations without proof, for anyone who is unclear on the meaning of that word. I had to look it up. People are beginning to suspect that this technology doesn't just materialize from nowhere. By way of just I'll make a microscopic processor. You know, meaning something so small we have to view it through a microscope, I presume.
Mm-hmm.
and the little bots and things like that. I mean, people are beginning to suspect that we're not only working with alien technology, but probably the aliens themselves. Where does this stuff come from? Where do these extraordinary ideas come from? I mean, I know they got nothing. These people are working on it, got nothing to do all day except work on it. But, man, we sure have made some quantum leaps, would be putting it mildly, in the technology that's out there and being refined and developed.
Yeah, I don't think it would take too much of a stretch of imagination to consider if we did have an encounter with an alien species that was far more advanced than we were, that given our state of consciousness and how we live in duality, the us and them, that I think we would try to get military technology out of them in order to foster our position on the planet in a greedy, selfish kind of way. I think we would do that based on where we are. So,
well, you know,
would they trade a military base that's guarded by our people for advanced technologies to include advanced military drives, communication protocols, to include CDMA and things like that? For sure they did, and I truly believe that.
Yeah, after a while, you know, there's enough evidence. You can't deny it after a point. And in fact, after the part about not only working with alien technology, but the aliens themselves, comes the, well, say, the world is running in such a zany way with the so-called adults who are, in fact, our leaders. I wonder if a lot of this stuff is being orchestrated from off-planet.
Well, a lot of that I covered in the very last chapter of my book, but based on the genealogy table that I came up with, starting with some research from Sitchin and Lawrence Gardner, and some of the declarations by the entities, the Anunnaki that were here themselves, that they stayed. It's pretty clear from their symbols and the governments that they've affiliated with that some of them did stay. And based on their behavior in the past, we're seeing the same thing now. It's practically like the Hatfields and McCoys, and it makes you wonder if these are our progenitors. Is there any hope for us? And I've had many readers ask me that.
Well, you know, we've got so much to talk about tonight. I'm going to jump around all over the place, and I will leave it up to you to kind of make it a little bit more linear, because I'm not a linear guy, really.
I'm not either, so we might be in trouble.
Okay, cool. Well, let's go over to this thing about the implant that can read brain signals in real time that DARPA's working on.
Right. Well, let's back up a little bit and talk about brainwave signals. First of all, we know that they operate from about 0 to 20 hertz. And then they got segregated into various regions. We call it delta, theta, alpha, and beta. And each one of those regions has certain attributes that humans have, like in the alpha stage, or actually in the beta stage, we're supposedly in our waking consciousness. So that's around anywhere from 10 to 13, 20 hertz, somewhere in there. If you're around 13 hertz, you're probably ADD.
Right.
So we know, it's a very limited range for brainwave, and we can measure this on an EEG. So what do we know about sensor fusion? We know that if you can bring all these things together, these disparate sensors, whether it's a CCD camera or something with a proximity sensor, whatever, and it's analogous to a human. We use our eyes and our ears and our touch and our taste and our sight or our feel, and we bring this all together, and it produces a thought in our brain where it's interpreted. And we can see this on an EEG. So it seems to me that what DARPA is up to is, do we have the technology to read a brainwave in real time and decode it? Probably yes. I mean, I'd say we've probably been able to do that for 50 years. Easy.
So we're looking at, right, that one's fixing a snap, interdiction, and they just take the person that just had the random brain flat away at that point? I mean, is that where we go? Is this like the ultimate pre-crime tool?
Well, with things like the electromagnetic spectrum, if you can transmit a signal that falls into the 0 to 20 hertz brainwave region, and that signal has a higher amplitude than the one that you're generating internally, then you're going to get jammed, essentially. So that in and of itself is an area to be watching out for. So if anybody's transmitting in the extreme low frequency range where humans are thinking, there ought to be cause for concern.
So I take it the tinfoil hat is not entirely a bad idea.
Well, I was looking at your website to see the extent to which you looked up radiation and frequency damage and its incursion on everybody. So I think you're well aware of the extent of which it can be used.
Well, now, by the same token, I've heard rumors that voices can be injected into people's heads. I take it that that's not that much of a stretch.
No, not much of a stretch at all. You want to do this brain implant, real-time DARPA thing, and then we'll do the call brain entrainment? Okay.
Yeah, let's talk about everything, man.
Well, I was reading through this article on what DARPA can do with a brain implant, and you know, it's all well and good, but you wonder why an organization like DARPA is proclaiming that they're going to work on things that are health, to focus on the health of actual humans. This is verbatim from what they say. Well, since when is DARPA involved in the health of improving the health of actual humans? So that's kind of a front in and of itself. I don't believe that at all. And they also claim that it's in effect they're going to use this device that they mount to their skull to monitor, analyze, and respond to real-time information on the brain. Well, suppose you're giving a command to a soldier, and you want to make sure that they implement that command. Well, here's the ultimate device to go. Well, their intent is they're going to carry out this command or they're not. And now you've got a wire probed right to their head so you can determine that real-time. Well, what do you do if they say they're not going to follow the order?
Well, terminate their command.
Well, that's the part about it that gets scary. And you go down a few lines later, and they're talking about a deep brain stimulator technology, where it's not just a monitor, where there's telemetry going on, sensing, you know, brain waves, maybe temperature, blood flow, things like that. They're actually sending signals to various organs to get them to do things. So now you basically got a lab rat wired up. You're monitoring what they're thinking, and then predicating what to do in case they don't do what they're supposed to. This is pretty frightening. I wouldn't want that on me as a soldier.
You know, this is absolutely perverse, in my opinion. I mean, it's one thing to, you know, examine things and just see what's possible. It's another thing when you implement them. But I suppose the darker side of human nature, especially if you get a bunch of them together, just sort of compels them to say, well, let's see what we can mess with next. Is that where we are philosophically? If we can do it, then yeah, let's do it, rather than any moral restriction.
I think there's some of that. I think there's some running it up the flagpole to see how people respond. If they've turned the populace into enough of a sheeple where they won't respond, then they just keep bringing it on. So I think you've seen a lot of that going on right lately. And even worse, it looks like there's the White House with the new Brain Initiative program. Well, I just went and looked that up, and they're spending $100 million for the first year of this to essentially bridge what's going on between DARPA and the NIH. So this does not sound good. This sounds like major, major chip implant and control for the soldiers, because they're going to be the ones that volunteer and end up under the UCMJ. So what are they going to do when they tell, well, you know, you got to have this for the telemetry reasons and battlefield, reduce your post-traumatic stress disorder or whatever it is that you think you're getting. And they're not going to have a choice.
How far, I know your crystal ball is probably in the shop too, but maybe it worked better than mine. How far out do you estimate we are from deployment of this technology?
Well, it's already been deployed is the worst part. The brain stimulating technology has been used on Parkinson's patients. Over 100,000 of them in this country have a brain implant that looks to be a really wonderful thing. Okay, it started out as a wonderful thing. It looks like it mitigates the lack of dopamine in the substantia nigra, so that when they get the shakiness from, or rigidity from Parkinson's and the shakiness, or they get the other extreme of Huntington's chorea, this electrical stimulation to the brain is actually working. So, but taking that to where we're talking about applying it to soldiers is a whole other matter, and what they could do with that, you know, sensing intent versus issuance of commands. And that's a real problem. And you end up in a situation in the military where you're told to do things, and it results in destruction of things and killing people. And a lot of times your consciousness is going to say, well, this is not the right circumstance. I don't want to do this. And so what are you going to do? You can reject the order and risk the punishment that could come with it. In a battlefield situation, it could be quite severe.
Well, I'm thinking that, it's bad enough within the military context, but It sounds to me like you could make the general population just do pretty much whatever you want them to do.
Well, that goes back to this idea of putting a signal into someone's head. Now, how can that be done? Well, it can be done inaudibly, which is the really scary part. It really, you know, in my book, I talk about how you can combine a couple of frequencies and have the difference, the sum of the difference gets produced in a waveguide. Well, if one of those, the sum or the difference, lands into your brainwave region, delta, theta, alpha, or beta, 0 to 20 hertz, you could have a problem because when you generate a signal by producing it that way, your ears don't just hear it. It goes deeper than that into your primitive part of your brain that senses the triangulation of sound. And through that process, they call it entrainment, you can actually cause the brain to change frequency. You can have to change frequency to whatever you want. But that's all well and good, but there's also brain wave patterns that they found that if you change a little bit of alpha and a little bit of beta and you perturb them back and forth, for instance, you can cause really cognitive dissonance type problems in humans. And this has been documented as the Soviets were transmitting to our diplomats and hitting them these frequencies to see if they do, and back and forth. And there's even something called the Lily wave. If you check and see, it's a signal that supposedly is being put on all the electrical signals through all your homes on the DC backbone. So if you look up the Lily wave, you'll see that there are people with a logic analyzer out there looking at it going, what is this doing here? And why is it, you know, it's perturbing humans. Why are they doing this?
And if we were to look up, what did you call it?
It's a Lily wave, L-I-L-L-Y.
Lily wave. Good Lord, I've never even heard of it.
Yeah. It's like a little impulse and then a short pause, and then you'll see a spike with two inverted spikes on a frequency domain. It's kind of a insidious thing, and there's been a lot of research into what various electromagnetic signals can do with humans, especially by the government. And this is an area that has been extremely off limits ever to talk about. I'm surprised we've gotten this far on the show.
So am I.
I think it's recorded. Wilhelm Reich and Raymond Rife, who found a cure for all diseases using frequency. You know, so anytime energy in the human body come in contact, the government's all over it.
You know, this is disturbing, mostly because, well, you know, there's no point in beating that horse. The whole bloody thing is disturbing, right?
Well, it is, especially when you really start to understand the extent to which human body is 90%+ water. And, you know, if you can put something in the microwave and cause it to heat up, well, you can imagine what those microwave frequencies are doing to the human body.
Augmented by that stuff.
If we felt something heating us up, we'd go, oh, there's something heating me up. I better back off. But it's just below that threshold. The damage can be done. You never know it.
I got to tell you something.
What's that?
I knew this was going to be a good one, but this is almost a little bit too good. Well, let's carry on as best we can before somebody out there decides, all right, that's enough from you guys. And we get that sound again that's indescribably weird. All right, when we come back, let's just get into everything else. I mean, we'll eventually arrive at the Anunnaki element and everything that goes with it. All right, our guest tonight is Gerald Clark. His book is The Anunnaki of Nibiru. I'll get a pronunciation from him on that in a minute. Mankind's Forgotten Creators, Enslavers, Saviors, and Hidden Architects of the New World Order. Don't look now, but here it comes. This is Coast to Coast AM.